Essential workers are organizing walkouts and pressing for better coronavirus protections, and their bosses aren't too happy.
A lot of workers feel things are rigged, and that's one reason that a lot of blue-collar workers voted for Trump. They thought he would solve this rigging problem. In many ways, things are as rigged as ever against them.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 29th, a look at the role of labor unions during the coronavirus pandemic. Also, the baseball season is off to a rocky start because of COVID-19.
The idea was never to have a baseball season and have no one get sick. So when you come in with that assumption, I think that makes the question of liability a little bit different. But you're dealing with human behavior here.
And then how companies are moving toward making fashion more accessible for people living with disabilities. But first, we visit the suburbs and how President Trump is trying to galvanize white voters using a page from an old political playbook. Ah, suburbia.
The suburbs. Almost as much written about as Madison Avenue. And just as much in need of reflection. Like Madison Avenue, life in the suburbs has its good moments and others not so good. Discouraged? Disgruntled? Heck no. They're glad to be here.
According to President Trump, however, this idyllic picture of the suburbs from the 1950s is coming to an end. In the past month, the president has repeatedly claimed that an Obama-era affordable housing initiative called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, or AFFH, is actively working to destroy the suburbs. Here's President Trump saying this three different times just this month.
The AFFH is a disaster. It's been a disaster. It's ruining the suburbs, it's destroying the suburbs, it's bringing down values of houses, and it's bringing up crime.
Mothers aren't happy about that, fathers aren't happy about that. They worked hard to buy a house, and now they're gonna watch the housing values drop like a rock, and that has happened.
Your home will go down in value, and crime rates will rapidly rise. Joe Biden and his bosses from the radical left want to significantly multiply what they're doing now. And what will be the end result is you will totally destroy the beautiful suburbs. Suburbia will be no longer as we know it.
The president's rhetoric is in line with the legacy of dog whistle political messages that have often been a staple of racist housing policies for decades. According to the Bloomberg City Lab, people of color accounted for the vast majority of suburban growth between 2000 and 2010, and that could mean that appeals to preserve white suburban communities may reflect an outdated vision of what the suburbs really are and could fall flat with voters in November. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway. Joining me now is Richard Rothstein, the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
Also joining me is Tarini Party, national politics reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Tarini, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We're talking a little bit about these messages and how the Trump administration has sort of been using the suburbs as almost a target here for his upcoming to garner support. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how politicians have appealed to suburbanite voters historically. Is this common?
That's right. So what we saw in the 1960s is the Republican Party using this sort of similar message to reach Southern, especially Southern suburban voters. They were targeting white women in the suburbs, using this sort of law and order strategy here to appeal to these types of voters. That's how the Republican Party consolidated the South and suburbs across the country. And led to, you know, Richard Nixon's win. And from then on out, even in congressional races, they started winning the districts in the suburbs. And what we're seeing now is President Trump trying to use that same strategy. But the way he's doing it is sort of more, you know, explicit than and more overt than other Republican candidates have even done. And the what's different now than what it was, you know, decades ago is that we're seeing suburbs changing, as you mentioned. We're seeing demographic changes all across the country in suburbs. We're seeing rapid population growth in liberal-leaning cities. And then those people are moving into suburbs, diversifying them. And, you know, they don't feel the same way they did about, a lot of people living in suburbs don't feel the same way they did about race 40 years ago. We're seeing increased support for, you know, recent protests against racial injustice. So it's definitely a different landscape, but the president is still trying to use that same old, you know, it was called the Southern strategy.
So Richard, the vision that we heard of the suburbs at the top of the show with sort of the birds chirping and the white picket fence and the couples wearing their press shirts, all of that was actually real, right?
Well, the federal government created suburbs for working class families in the mid-20th century. There were always suburbs, but prior to the end of World War II, they were mostly only affluent families who were living in them. Single-family homes, separately constructed, not large subdivisions. The subdivisions that ring every American city now were created as whites-only single-family home suburbs in the post-World War II period, primarily, by the federal government. The most famous of these is probably Levittown, east of New York City, 17,000 homes in one place. Developer William Levitt could never have developed that suburb on his own. Nobody would lend him the money to build 17,000 homes for which he had yet had no buyers. The only way he could build that development, and this was true of developers all over the country, many of them with suburbs just as large as Levittown, the only way they could build it was by going to the Federal Housing Administration and the Veterans Administration, submitting their plans for the development, the design of the homes, the architecture, the layout of the streets, and a commitment that the federal government required never to sell a home to an African American. The federal government even required that these developers, like Levitt, place a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. And this was not the action of rogue bureaucrats in the Federal Housing Administration or Veterans Administration. It was written in a federal housing manual called the Underwriting Manual that was distributed to appraisers all over the country, whose job it was to evaluate applications of developers for federal bank guarantees for their loans. The manual
so
said that
this was policy, Richard, is what you're saying. I mean, it wasn't sort of an unwritten rule. These were actually written policies that explicitly said, keep black renters and homeowners out of this community.
Absolutely. The manual said not only could you not rent or sell to an African-American, you couldn't even get a bank guarantee for an all-white development that was going to be located near where African-Americans were living, because in the words of the manual, that would run the risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial groups. So this was a very explicit policy.
Right. And that point right there, the idea of infiltration, the idea that that people are coming to infiltrate your community is, I think, one that's directly connected to fear here. Tarini, we're talking a little bit about this messaging from the president, and he's continued. We heard at the top of the show to say, you know, your property values are going to go down. Tarini, you know, when you hear that, is that, and I want to bring to mind a vision, an image that I think a lot of us have seen. There was a couple who, during a Black Lives Matter protest, came to the front of their homes with guns in their hands, and just the look of fear on their faces. Tarini, is President Trump's message actually resonating? And when I think about the McCluskeys with their guns on their lawn pointing them at black and brown protesters, I wonder if that is just where this message is landing.
I think it does resonate with a certain percentage of voters, especially in the suburbs that the president is targeting. But, you know, I was in North Carolina recently in a suburb there that voted overwhelmingly for President Trump. And I spoke to a lot of people, and especially in talking to some women, what I heard was, you know, that their views on race have changed. And, you know, I talked to a 71-year-old woman who said, you know, she's changed a lot over the years, and that type of messaging is no longer resonating with her. What the president is trying to do is using this current debate over, you know, Confederate monuments, over, you know, the current protests, and using some of the more, you know, violent, the rare cases where we're seeing some violence. He's using that sort of imagery combined with these calls to defund the police, to sort of sell that message of fear. You know, we're seeing this new ad that's been running where, you know, someone calls the police and they say it's a voicemail and says, you know, press one for robbery, or, you know, we can't take your call right now because the police has been defunded. So he's sort of, you know, combining all the things that are going on and layering that with this message of, you know, these protesters, these violent people. You know, he's not explicitly saying, you know, which race they are, but it's pretty clear what he's talking about. And using that sort of fear to target a lot of these suburban voters.
Richard, we've heard the president's appeals at the very top of the show here a couple times this month. He's essentially saying your home values are going to go down. How factual is that? Has low-income housing, has the introduction of people of color and Black people, more specifically to suburbia, actually had that effect? I mean, we know, to Tarini's point, that the suburbs, if you will, have become more diverse. I don't know if that means they're more integrated, but do his claims hold any water?
Well, there are a couple of points here. First, let me say that when we say the suburbs are becoming more diverse, that's primarily not with African Americans. We consider communities to be integrated if any minority group comes into it. But African Americans still are primarily very distant from whites and where they live, and vice versa. So far as property values go, historically, property values have increased when African Americans have moved into communities, simply because they had so few options. African Americans were willing to pay more for housing than whites were willing to pay for similar housing. So typically, property values went up when African Americans moved in. The only time they went down was when real estate agents and speculators, we call them blockbusters, went into these communities when a few African Americans moved in, initially raising property values, and tried to panic whites into thinking that their property values would fall. The whites then sold their homes to these speculators at reduced prices, making the property values of the community go down. And the speculators turned around and sold them to African Americans at higher than market prices. The Federal Housing Administration was well aware of the research that property values increased when African Americans moved into a community. It ignored this research and propagated the myth that property values would decline if African Americans moved into a neighborhood.
Richard, during the pandemic, we've seen, I mean, there feel like there have been a couple things that have happened demographically with the suburbs. We saw, for example, in the 1970s, I would say, a lot of white flight from cities, white suburbanite or white middle class and upper middle class families moving out of the cities that they thought were decaying at the time and leaving. And then we saw a little bit of a pattern about a decade or two ago, where wealthier whites were moving back to the cities and causing sort of what was known as gentrification. The pandemic has now, I think maybe this is temporary, but I feel like there are lots of folks who said they need to go back to the suburbs to find more space and more room, and if they're going to socially distance. Has that shift meant anything right now, Richard, or is this just a temporary blip because of the pandemic?
Well, I don't think that's a real issue. Most of the people who are gentrifying these neighborhoods are not the families that have been traditionally living in suburbs. These are younger professionals who don't yet have large families and are gentrifying urban areas. The families of two, three children that have always lived in the suburbs are continuing to live there. They're not moving into gentrifying areas. And so I don't think there's any issue of them now wanting to move back. The young people can't afford to move to suburbs. The suburbs are now too expensive for young people, even young professionals, to live in the suburbs where they grew up. So I think that the trends you're talking about of young professionals moving into cities is going to continue. They can't afford to live in suburbs, and families are going to stay in the suburbs.
Tarini, how successful have Republicans been with white suburban voters over time?
They've been very successful. You know, it's been suburban voters have been a key part of the Republican voting bloc, their coalition that they've been able to establish. So, you know, the fact that there's some Republican voters in these suburbs that are questioning whether or not they're going to vote for the president is a big deal, not just for 2020, but in the future. You know, if they get turned off by the Republican Party as a whole, or if it's, you know, it might just not be a frustration with the president, but with down ballot candidates that are sort of repeating what the president says and going along with what he says. If it becomes a frustration with the party as a whole, then we could see this key voting block for the Republican Party shift away. And that could make a huge difference, you know, in places like North Carolina, even Georgia, maybe even Texas. So we could see parts of the South and, you know, the Sun Belt with places in Arizona really becoming more competitive and favorable to Democrats.
Richard, President Trump has taken aim at the Fair Housing Act. Could you remind our listeners what that act was intended to do and what is most concerning to you when you hear the rhetoric from the president that's taking aim at this specific protection?
The Fair Housing Act prohibited ongoing discrimination in housing. It didn't do anything to undo the existing segregation that we had created, that the government had created in the previous decades. There is a provision in the Fair Housing Act that requires communities to assess the extent to which they're segregated and why that happened, and to come up with proposals to redress that. Those proposals never came into effect before the Trump administration took office and repealed, really, the Fair Housing Act requirement that communities make this assessment. So this notion that the affirmatively furthering fair housing provision of the act has somehow destroyed suburbs is pure fiction. It didn't even come into effect before Trump took office.
And so why, I mean, are there concerns about whether or not the Fair Housing Act, that provision in particular, will just not be, won't have an effect, or that the broader act itself could be at risk?
Well, the broader act won't be at risk. The broader act prohibits ongoing discrimination in the sale and rental of housing. It needs to be better enforced. There have been a number of studies showing that real estate agents still steer African Americans away from white neighborhoods when they sell homes. So it needs much, much better enforcement. The affirmatively furthering provision, which requires communities to take affirmative steps to try to undo the segregation that they've created, that should be reinstituted. And hopefully a new administration will reinstitute such a provision and will try to make some progress in undoing the previous segregation. But the prohibition on ongoing discrimination just needs to be better enforced.
Tarini, you said you've been talking to voters in the suburbs, and I'm just wondering whether or not voters are being, whether or not Joe Biden, who is the presumptive Democratic nominee, has actually addressed this issue at all specifically, or whether any of the Democrats have policies that might have an effect on this voting bloc in particular.
Well, The presumptive nominee, Joe Biden, has definitely been, you know, targeting some of these Republican voters. And the voters I spoke with, I should note, weren't saying that they are ready to vote for Joe Biden yet. They said they won't vote for President Trump, but they're not ready to sort of take that next step at the moment. But they are listening to the policies that that Biden is coming out with. And, you know, we're seeing the president label him as this radical left, you know, kind of trying to portray him as a socialist. And we saw Biden yesterday pushed back and sort of laid out his policies, you know, especially about the economy, something that that a lot of suburban voters do care about and usually, you know, vote on as a top issue. We're seeing him address the economy, especially as it relates to recovery from the coronavirus. So those types of policies, the more he talks about them, could appeal to those types of Republican suburban voters that are, you know, seemingly up for grabs this election.
Tarini Partee is a national politics reporter at The Wall Street Journal, and Richard Rothstein is the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This week, we've been talking about some of the challenges facing people with disabilities in the United States 30 years after the landmark Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. And so far, we've looked at issues like voting and navigating city streets, but people with disabilities also face challenges when it comes to the clothes they wear. Today, about 1 in 4 adults in the United States live with a disability. And for many, it can be difficult to find clothing that's both stylish and functional. And that started to change in recent years, with the fashion industry moving toward more accessible and inclusive options. In 2016, Tommy Hilfiger made history when it launched Tommy Adaptive, a clothing line specifically for people with disabilities.
Magnets rather than buttons. Jeans that have Velcro. T-shirts that are easily accessible.
Since then, other brands and retailers from Zappos to Target have followed suit, though overall progress has been slow. Kia Brown recently wrote about accessible fashion for the New York Times. She's a journalist and author of the book, The Pretty One. Kia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So in your piece, you talk about your journey and the role that fashion has played and how you feel about yourself. Tell us a little bit about what that means.
It means that for a very long time, I used fashion to shield myself away from the world. I have cerebral palsy, and so I would often get bigger shirts to pull sleeves over my hands so nobody could see it, or I would try to become invisible in my clothing. And then when I realized that I could live a much better life learning to love myself, I use fashion as a form of expression. You know, it's an extension of my personality. And so it really means a lot to me because it was with me on this journey from the very beginning to where I am now. And I think that we deserve clothes that reflect who we are, but are also accessible.
You ultimately, this journey has ultimately led you to create the hashtag Disabled and Cute, which is wonderful. What's the response been to the hashtag?
It's been wonderful. People have been using it for years, which I think says a lot. To see it still being used years on is really, you know, the best thing that I could have ever hoped for.
You mentioned that you've gone through the 5 stages of fashion grief. What does that mean?
It means that I have gone through the stages of being angry at fashion, of being saddened by fashion, of bargaining with fashion to care about people like me. And it really took me accepting myself to also accept fashion and be able to critique it because I know that it can be better. I always say that we critique the things we love because we know the potential that they have. And so I'm at a place in my 5 stages where I'm accepting fashion for what it is, but also hoping that it can be better.
What we heard a little bit of from Tommy Hilfiger at the top of the segment, talking about some of the ways that the inclusive line that they created was inclusive. What is accessible fashion to you? What how do you define it today? Is it having things like magnets instead of buttons, or is there something else to it?
I mean, that is definitely a part of it. I really believe that we deserve clothes that are easy to put on and take off. But also, I think some of the issues with accessible fashion now is that we forego style for function. And for me, accessible fashion is as much about style as it is function. So yes, magnets instead of buttons, a moratorium on zippers, please. Like, let's cut zippers out as well. Something that's easy to put on, something that you can, you know, open from sides or close. If I have to have a button, it would be better for me if the buttons are on the right side of the shirt. And then I can do it with the left side because my left is my stronger side. But I do think that accessible fashion itself is really about the experience of fashion. So that means both accessible options, but also making sure that it's as stylish as what you'd see for standard clothing today.
I've noticed, I used to cover advertising many years ago as a reporter, so I pay attention to a lot of the ads that we see both on television and online. And I've noticed that there are more, that there's more representation of people with disabilities in advertisements. But I'm wondering if that is following suit with just actual inclusivity when it comes to fashion. For example, you know, I've seen people with disabilities in Target ads, for example, but does that mean that, I don't want to signal out Target, but does that mean that we are actually seeing more brands getting involved in creating fashion that is more accessible and inclusive?
I mean, I hope so, but that was the issue that I brought up in the piece, was that I didn't want to be talking about this another 2 years from now, only praising the same companies for doing the same work. You know, I think it is important that we, you know, praise places like Zappos and Tommy Adaptive and Open Style Lab, but at the same time, I want to see other brands step up to the challenge as well and say, hey, we also see what they're doing and want to put our own hat in the ring. I think it's very much a disservice to disabled people that dogs have more clothing options than we do.
I'd never considered that. And that's a really powerful thing to think about. Akia, I'm wondering whether or not there are brands that are wholly dedicated to creating inclusive and accessible fashion, or whether you would like to see some brands that that's their entire mission, that this isn't just a question of expanding a line, but this is the line.
Yes, I mean, I want to see that across the entire fashion industry. I think with respect to what's happening in the world right now with regard to COVID, that universal fashion is the way to go for the future. That it is imperative that we think of, you know, intentional design with regard to both accessible, stylish, and inclusive design. I think that the entire industry should think about ways in which we tell stories through clothes, but also the customers that we're asking to purchase these clothes. We live in a society where everybody has to wear clothes, and so disabled people are having to buy clothes 2 and 3 times because we have to get some things altered to fit our body. But wouldn't it be amazing if we lived in a world where we didn't have to buy clothes more than once, that we could just walk into a store or go into a store, even shop online, and have the option of buying clothes once that fit our bodies, have the option of telling our own stories and expressing our own selves through clothes without having to beg for just one extended line or just one special item of clothing.
I'm sure there are some fashion designers who are waiting for a new opportunity, and we'll see if anyone decides to pick that up and be innovative about it, Kia. Kia Brown is a journalist and author of the book, The Pretty One. Kia, thank you for spending some time with us.
It was wonderful. Thank you again for having me.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. The 2020 Major League Baseball season got underway last week, but so far, it's been rough. More than half of the active Miami Marlins players and several coaches from the team have tested positive for the coronavirus. And as a result, Marlins games have been postponed through at least Sunday. But despite concerns over additional outbreaks, Major League Baseball officials have so far balked at the idea of canceling this truncated season altogether. Here's MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred discussing the Marlins situation on ESPN on Monday.
I don't put this in the nightmare category. I mean, obviously, we don't want any player to get exposed. It's not a positive thing, but I don't see it as a nightmare. We built the protocols to allow us to continue to play. That's why we have the expanded rosters. That's why we have the pool of additional players. And we think we can keep people safe and continue to play.
I've got Jane McManus with me now. She's the director of the Marist Center for Sports Communication and a sports columnist for the New York Daily News. Jane, great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Rob Manfred, who we just heard, MLB commissioner there, sounded pretty confident, at least, that he was going to be able to keep his players safe. But the Marlins situation sounds quite alarming. Tell us, you know, how things have developed since the first cases were identified on the team.
The proof is in front of him. He hasn't been able to keep his players safe. So the question is, what do they do now? the way that this developed was after a game in on Sunday where the Marlins were playing the Phillies. Before that game, a player had tested positive for the coronavirus, and the team wanted to play that game anyway, and so went ahead and played. And of course, that opens the door to exposure, not just to the Marlins players, but also to the Phillies and to anybody who's been working in that clubhouse. And so what you have then is, you know, one test turning into multiple tests and an outbreak and a team, one of the 30 teams, not being able to play going forward and quarantined in Philadelphia until they can figure out how to move this season forward.
Who's responsible if people get sick?
I think that most of these players have come into the season, and I believe Major League Baseball has as well, assuming that people are going to be getting sick. The idea was never to have a baseball season and have no one get sick. So when you come in with that assumption, I think that makes the question of liability a little bit different. But you're dealing with human behavior here, right? So even in the NBA, where you have a bubble in Orlando, there was a player who, Lou Williams, a Clippers guard, who went to a strip club, you know, and broke protocols by doing that. You are going to be faced, as sports get back, with the same thing you're going to be faced with as colleges return, which is that human behavior is going to be chaotic. And it doesn't matter what your protocols are and how well you have everything. If you have a team like the Marlins that decide that they're going to play despite a positive case, well, there's really, you know, you can go back and examine it, but you're going to have things like that happening.
And Jane, what we hear often is when someone is concerned about having been exposed to the coronavirus or thinks they may have gotten it, that the protocol is to quarantine for 2 weeks. That doesn't sound like what's happening in the Marlins.
Well, they're in Philly right now, and they, you know, they're kind of waiting to see what they can do. I think the idea is that with these tests, that can kind of substitute for what a quarantine would be for regular citizens like you and I. If we were exposed to it, then it would be really important, because of the difficulty of getting a test, that we would be quarantined and not have exposure or interact with other people or go to the grocery store. But when you're able to get tested every day, I think the idea is that those tests can shave some of the time off of that quarantine. So what's happening now is that Major League Baseball is testing pretty, you know, every single day, the Marlins, the Phillies, the Yankees, all of the teams that may have somehow become exposed because of this positive test on the Marlins.
I guess the big question here, and I love baseball as much as anyone else, and, you know, love the sound of it, love going to games, love all of it. Do we love it enough to want to put people's lives at risk? I mean, is it necessary? What's driving this insistence on playing baseball?
You bring up a great point. A baseball player is not an essential worker. We don't need baseball in our society right now the way that we might need other things, like schools, for example. And I think you have to look big picture and say, well, so what is driving this return to sports? Is it going to ultimately keep us from being able to have some of the other things that we like, right? The way that opening bars has made it difficult to have schools open up in the fall. One of the reasons that baseball is getting started and you see so many sports is because there was a moment back in May where it looked like we had been able to drive down the rate of transmission in this country, and that there were places in this country where you might be able to have games and it might return to normal in a way. We'd seen games come back in South Korea. We'd seen games come back in Germany. We'd seen games come back in Spain. If those places could do it, then why couldn't we do it here in the United States? And so plans were being made as that was happening. And what happened in this country, as you know very well, because you cover it every day, is that we did not get the virus under control. So instead of having conditions where players are going back in, we're behaving in a safe manner, and games are being able to be played, instead what you have is a virus so out of control that it's very difficult to imagine a season right now. And if you were planning now, you probably wouldn't do it this way.
The NFL, as we know, decided not to start their season in a bubble. I'm hearing reports that some football players are saying, I don't want to go on the field. And so what are we looking for when it comes to football, which is, supposed to be starting relatively soon?
I think right now what you're having is players opting out of the season, and they're allowed to do that. Right now, if you're a high-risk player, you can opt out and get a $350,000 stipend for not playing the season. And a lot of players have come out and they've made videos about, you know, here are the reasons I'm opting out. And Marquise Goodwin had, you know, had his daughter with him, his baby daughter, and says, this is why I'm opting out. You know, she's my priority and I've got to make sure she's safe right now. And so I think you're seeing a lot of players kind of take that into account. There's actually a doctor, a medical doctor, who's a guard for the Chiefs. And he came out and said that, you know, having worked on the front lines, worked in a hospital during the pandemic, he just couldn't see putting that stress on the healthcare system. But there are a lot of economic interests that are coming in, whether it's broadcasters who need those that money from advertising to be able to make a go of it. I mean, you're starting to see a lot of stress on the economics of sports right now.
I was just going to ask you whether or not that's one of the driving forces, because they've lost ticket sales, at least for the time being. So now the reliance on ad dollars seems to be even heavier.
It's critical. And you know, I think you look and you see, if you look at the pyramid that is, you know, underneath a game, right, you see the people who work for the teams. You see people who work in the locker room. There are seasonal employees that come in just for the games that are being played. And that is a large part of it. And, you know, college sports is another situation where you have players who aren't being paid, who are being told to come into different college facilities to train. And they are also large outbreaks on a lot of these teams. And those are players that aren't compensated and who have to buy their own insurance. So you even have different, I mean, that situation, I think, is one where you really can look at it and say, is it ethical to be bringing these players back, putting them at this risk, many of them from Black and brown communities that have been ravaged by this virus, and so that they can make money for their predominantly white institutions and predominantly white coaches.
All super interesting points, as always. Jane McManus is the director of the Marist Center for Sports Communication and a sports columnist for the New York Daily News. Jane, thank you so much.
I appreciated the conversation.
Throughout the pandemic, workers for Amazon, McDonald's, Instacart, and other companies have organized against unsafe labor conditions that have left many vulnerable to COVID-19. But despite the increased visibility of labor organizing in the United States, union membership is still on the decline. A little more than 10% of workers in the United States said they belonged to a union in 2019. A new study from Duke University showed that congressional lawmakers are more responsive to working class constituencies with a larger union presence. And that could mean that a more significant union presence nationwide might make a difference for the labor issues that workers have faced in the age of COVID-19. I spoke to Stephen Greenhouse, former New York Times labor reporter and the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor.
Among young Americans, 67% say approve of unions, think unions are a really good thing for the nation. That's the highest of any age group. And you know, many young workers, you know, they're really joining unions. And of all the industrial nations, corporations in America fight harder to keep out unions. You know, at Trader Joe's, which is, you know, generally a very good company, some workers were complaining back in March about the company not doing enough on COVID-19. And a few days later, you know, the respected, you know, CEO of Trader Joe's sends out a letter to everyone saying, you know, we don't need a union. They just get in the way. They're selfish. So employers have the right to propagandize against unions, to tell workers unions aren't, you know, you don't need them. You don't need to pay dues. But it's illegal for employers to intimidate workers or strong arm workers to vote against unions. And many workers say that they are intimidated, that they feel strong armed, their boss will call them into a one-on-one session and say, you know, are you going to vote for a union? And that's kind of per se intimidation. So in my book, I explain the gazillion ways that many employers twist workers' arms, sometimes illegally, to get them to vote against unions. And I would think that if, you know, 50% of American workers were unionized rather than 6% in the private sector, corporations would be acting much more responsibly and responsively in handling safety matters on COVID-19, and we wouldn't see nearly as much income inequality, and we wouldn't have seen these decades of wage stagnation. And you know, many economists have pointed out that as unions in the United States have grown weaker from, you know, 1 in 3 workers in unions 50, 60 years ago to just 1 in 10 today, income inequality has grown and wage stagnation has really prevailed decade after decade. So in ways, you know, a lot of workers feel things are rigged. And that's one reason, believe it or not, that a lot of blue-collar workers voted for Trump. They thought he would solve this rigging problem. But I think a lot of workers have discovered that in many ways things are as rigged as ever against them, in ways more so. And I think that COVID-19 has made many workers feel, gosh, things are rigged. I'm losing my job. There's not enough safety precautions at work. Oh, they're forcing me back to my job, even though it's dangerous. If I don't go back, I'm going to lose unemployment insurance, and they're not going to let me sue if I get sick.
Did we see an outgrowth from what happened 2 or 3 months ago with these low-wage workers, you know, putting pressure on larger companies that actually will extend to some sort of more organized action, for example, a union?
So we did see walkouts, you know, sometimes just a few dozen workers, sometimes a few hundred workers, you know, at Amazon, at Whole Foods. You know, there's a nationwide Instacart strike in several different cities. And that really got the company's attention. It got the media's attention. It really embarrassed a lot of the companies. And I think some of them have taken, you know, significant steps to improve safety from, you know, from COVID-19. And I often think, were it not for, you know, these workers feeling emboldened and sticking their necks out and risking their jobs by going on strike, if it weren't for that, the companies might not have stepped up and begun to do nearly enough. You know, we're seeing a lot of strikes, a lot of worker militancy, a lot of anger. And the next step is, you know, will they form unions? You know, some MIT professors did a big survey, big study 2 years ago that found that 50% of non-union, non-managerial workers in the United States say they'd like to join a union if they could. Yet only 10% of workers are in unions and just 6.2% in the private sector. So there's this weird disconnect that, you know, millions and tens of millions and tens of millions of American workers want to join a union, but they really can't, partly, you know, largely because corporations fight so hard against it. And one of the big points I make in my book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, is that, you know, workers in the U.S. often feel that things are rigged against them, that you know, they're not getting enough wage increases, that income inequality is getting worse. And unfortunately, you know, that's the result of worker power in the U.S. being so much weaker than in other industrial nations. And unfortunately, you know, in the U.S., I argue in the book, you know, corporations in ways just have too much power. And we've seen, you know, the minimum wage hasn't been increased nationwide in over a decade. And I think corporations just too often forget about the importance of listening to workers. They're too often not concerned enough about what's good for workers and the safety of workers. And I think we've really seen that play out with COVID-19 and companies not doing enough on PPE and other things.
Has the response to the coronavirus and opening the economy been different in countries where unions are more powerful?
So in many European countries, you know, France and Germany and Denmark and Norway, and even in Britain with its very conservative government headed by Boris Johnson, they acted to protect workers and jobs first and then protect companies. In the United States, it was opposite. The Trump administration and the Senate really rushed to protect corporations and not so much to protect workers' jobs. And what all these European countries did is they enacted laws telling companies, we'll pay 80, 75, 90% of your payroll, that you will then use that money to pay your workers' salaries, and don't fire them, don't lay them off. So it didn't create the huge commotion, confusion, distress that we saw in the United States, where 40 million workers lost their jobs, and so many workers, you know, had a heck of a time getting unemployment insurance. And we saw these insanely large, you know, food bank lines. And talk about the system being rigged. You know, I've interviewed workers in Florida who said it's taken weeks, months for me to get unemployment insurance. And finally, after 2 months, you know, when my family didn't have enough food and I finally get unemployment insurance, they're saying I have to go back to work. And if I don't go back to work, I'm not going to get unemployment insurance. And that person, you know, feels screwed, rigged, you know, eight ways to Sunday. And you know, I think a lot of workers are really angry and they really want change. I think, you know, they want unions, but a lot of people don't know about unions. And a lot of unions, you know, there's so much anger around the country in ways it's hard for unions to address, to reach out and help all those workers.
That was Stephen Greenhouse, former New York Times labor reporter and author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.